Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 19 of the PreparedX podcast. In this one, we are going to be discussing, or I'm going to be discussing how hostiles prepare for an attack. So we decided to do this podcast based on a number of recent world events, which are in the news almost daily, but also based on a short article that I put together on LinkedIn a few years ago. That got a lot of traction, a lot of comments, a lot of likes, a lot of shares. And that article was How Hostiles Prepare to Attack. We'll make sure we add a link into the show notes that links to that article. It's an article that's on LinkedIn. I think even we blogged about it as well. So it was a very well-received article. But based on that, we decided to put this particular podcast together. And so, as we've seen in recent, you know, certainly in the last year, if we go back to Paris, if we go back to the Brussels terrorist attacks, as well as some more recent events here in the States, we've had the police ambushed. You know, we have the Dallas and Baton Rouge recently, and then the horrendous Nice attack, you know, that took place. You know, there was one theme in all these events, as well as most other events that take place on this scale. And that theme is that those individuals, those perpetrators, whether it be an individual, be it a group, you know, have typically gone through a series of actions. They've planned these events. They've thought about them. They've researched. They've gone through a methodical and thorough planning process, which we'll come on to later on in this podcast. And so how does the adversary prepare to attack? Are there things that we can do as an organization, as individuals traveling, or as individuals in our own communities where we can potentially prevent these, or at least notice signs that you know, something might be out of place? You know, so what can we do? And we'll try and answer some of these questions as we go through this podcast. And so I'd like to go back, though, to an event a few years previous to the ones I just mentioned. I'd like to go back to July 22nd of 2011. And for those of you that remember the attack that took place in Norway, there was an individual, Anders Breivik, who killed 8 people by detonating a vehicle bomb in Oslo. And then if you remember, he then traveled and murdered 69 individuals on an island that were attending a Workers' Youth League summer camp. And this is all well documented online, so you can find this information through various searches. But I'm going to talk a little bit about this individual. I've read one particular book on him, had a troubled upbringing, but there's a lot of information that was found out about this individual after the attack, and a lot of it was around how he methodically went through the process of planning for this attack. And this was fairly sophisticated because there was a large you know, vehicle bomb, as I mentioned, but also he went through the trouble of disguising himself as a policeman to get across to the island, where he then methodically went around the island and killed lots of young individuals, which was pretty tragic. So anyway, I'm going to go through the timeline. And again, I'm going to go from my show notes here, and we'll provide those show notes to you. I'm just going to go through that timeline and talk a little bit about you know, kind of what happened, and then what afterwards, you know, kind of some of the things that happened prior. So I'm going to do it a little bit backwards. So the car bomb went off. It was a Friday, if I'm not mistaken. I see my notes here, and it was at 3:30 local time in the afternoon. And it was done outside the Prime Minister's office, and it had, you know, pretty devastating effect. I remember at the time it went viral on various social media sites, and it just so happens that I had been on Twitter, or I had seen it pop up somewhere, and so I started to track it on Twitter. I remember there were several hundred tweets every second about this, so it was a significant event that was being tracked online, people posting their experience. But what people didn't realize that once that went off, that individual then, I think it was probably a 20 mile or 25 miles northwest of Oslo, traveled up to the island, and it was around 5 o'clock, so it was an hour and a half later, where there was a ferryman approached by what appeared to be a policeman, and that individual was asked to take him across to the island. And that individual was in uniform, appeared to be a police officer, looked like an official, was carrying an assault rifle as well as a pistol, I believe a bag as well. But and apparently, as the story goes, he described that he was there to do research in connection with the bomb blast. And the bomb blast had only just gone off literally an hour and a half earlier. But, the ferryman who took him across was not to know that at the time. So he was transported across to the island. And then once he got across to the island, sadly, he went around the island and, killed all those young people on the island, which was, again, tragic event. They had nowhere to go. Some tried to swim away. Some hid in rocks. Again, nowhere to go. Pretty small island. Then it wasn't too long after, I believe the timeline that I did research on, the SWAT dispatched to the island at 17:26 hours, so 5:26 local time. And then they arrived at just after 6 o'clock, so it took them another 30 minutes, 40 minutes to get out to the island. And actually he gave himself up some 20 minutes later, so he gave himself up at the police time here is 18:27, so 6:27. By his own admission through court testaments, he had been planning this attack since 2009. And so 2 years in the planning for this attack. So done a lot of research, had been allegedly to the site in Oslo by all accounts multiple times to walk through and drive through that particular location. He apparently did come to the attention of Norway's intelligence services in 2011 after he bought a large quantity of chemicals from a Polish company. This emerged obviously in the research and the investigation afterwards, but there was no follow-up conducted by Norway's police service, and I assume they took a lot of flack over that. And there's much more to this story in terms of how this panned out. There's, I'll put the details of the book that I read. It was a very good book, Troubled History, for this individual. But it also talks about the planning that he went through in terms of the amount of times he visited the locations, how he got the information, the use of the internet. Everything else seemed, pretty normal with the individual. But there are a number of things, a number of flags that did come up where, maybe a little bit more research, a little bit more due diligence by the police services there could have, and other signs as well from individuals within the community. But nothing too obvious. So his story really was, why did he do this? He was really against the multiculturalism of Norway, of Norway's society. And so, he was anti-Islam, very extreme. And so, part of his aim was to put a stop to that. He really wanted to punish the people, who he thought were responsible for the multiculturalism within Norway. So that was kind of his aim. His method of attack, as I mentioned, was a car bomb and, you know, the firearms attack on the island. The use of reconnaissance, there was extensive online research, along with at least 8 that we know of or that was have been documented visits to the various locations. And, you know, he used deception specifically when he, purchased on the internet a police uniform or a mock police uniform and fake identification. So he went into a lot of detail of making himself blend in and, you know, be accepted, certainly to get across to the island or, and on his way probably out of the city as well. And so that's just, again, I want to go back to that event because, you know, sometimes we seem to forget about historical events. And that was, you know, certainly has been etched in Norway's society and will take a long time to heal. So I'll just talk about the 3 steps that hostiles take. And this individual in Norway, you know, the terrorists in Paris and Brussels, you know, those individuals who planned methodically to ambush the police recently in Dallas, as well as in Baton Rouge, and then as well as the individual in Nice, who, by the way, you know, again reading the early reports, had driven that white truck down that road several days leading up to the attack. So let's talk about the 3 typical steps that a hostile will take leading up to the attack. And again, you know, we use attack as typically a physical event, but this also, if it's a cyber individual or cyber group, a lot of their research, you know, follows a similar kind of process in terms of how leading up to the attack, what they do. So the first one is target selection. So what is the target? You know, is that a location? Is it an individual? Is it an event, as we saw in Nice? Is it an organization? What is it? Is it an individual that we're looking to target, or that the hostile is looking to target? And so once that's chosen through the reconnaissance, both online and it can actually be physical as well, you know, that selection, there may be more than one. They may determine as an individual that some of those locations have better security, or some of those events or individuals have better security locations, buildings, and therefore they may move on and select a different target. And so that's really important when you start to think about your security posture as an organization, as an individual, as a group. Second part is the planning. So, you know, we've selected the target. You know, a big part of the planning in this day and age can be done online. We all are familiar with Google Earth and the various other tools that you can gather information on. You can, you know, literally plot yourself on a road next to a building, and you can literally see around a building or a location to see what type of security they may have. Yes, the data may be slightly old, the information that you're seeing, but it gives you a good general overview. So they'll go through that second phase, which is the planning phase, and again, they'll do that from a distance as much as they can. If they need to get closer, then they'll go in and do the physical reconnaissance as well. And so that's the planning phase. And then there's a, you know, typically a third phase before the attack, and that's the, and again, these are general 3 steps that they go through, and that's the confirmation. So that's a confirmation that you know, the attack can go ahead. Is there still barriers that I can get through with the vehicle? So that was, I know that was part of the Nice attack as well. One of the reports I had read that he had actually been there on the afternoon prior to the evening attack, actually been and walked down that route. So he was potentially making sure that the vehicles could still actually get down that road. And anyway, that wasn't confirmed, but it was certainly something that one of the reports I had read said that he was doing that. So again, that's, you know, that just goes back to that confirmation period that they go through. And so those are the 3, you know, again, those are the 3 steps that a typical hostile, an adversary, will take in terms of preparing and going through an attack. And so I guess, you know, ask yourself this question, ask your organization this question, or even you as an individual, are there more things that we can do to our locations, our buildings, our events, our personnel, in terms of being able to, you know, think about how can we protect ourselves better? Are our security measures good? What's our digital footprint like? What information do we give away online? Have you assessed that? Have you looked at what employees are talking about online? Have you looked on your website and how much information you give away about various locations, about assets, about what you do online? Obviously, online is a very good place to be in terms of selling, in terms of explaining to your stakeholders what you do and how you do things. But is it too much? Are we giving the adversary a potential leg up in terms of preparing themselves for an attack? And so the digital footprint, taking a look at that once in a while can be very, very useful. So you should certainly start to think about that. And you know, some of the other questions you may want to ask, talking about the digital footprint, have you had a formal online risk assessment conducted? And so there are services available for people to look at your organization from the adversary's perspective. So when we conduct physical risk assessments, if we're doing it from within the organization, if we're a member of the security team, if we're a part of the risk assessment makeup of our organization, we're typically very comfortable doing a risk assessment from the inside. But if you get somebody from the outside who does this professionally to look at your organization from how an adversary, how a terrorist, how anyone who's looking, a hostile that's looking to get something from the organization. Again, this can be a physical event. This could be them to just gathering information. It could be a personal thing. It could be a whole host of reasons. But you know, if you've not had something like that conducted, then think about having one of those conducted at least at one of your locations, because you may find that there are things happening at one location that may be happening at all locations that make you much more vulnerable to some kind of event. And as I mentioned, that might be cyber related as well, and not just, you know, some kind of physical event that that could happen against your organization. Start there and then move on to the physical aspect. Start with a digital look at your organization, and then start to look at, you know, the physical aspect of it as well. And then, you know, from there you can start to put together some kind of overview of what your organization looks like from an adversary standpoint, and then you can start to close those gaps. And again, that might be with procedures, it might be, you know, physical things at your locations, or it could be, you know, online, as I mentioned. It could be various things that you're saying online or that you're not saying online that will prevent someone, or that will, you know, that will make somebody looking at your organization say, they're a harder target, let me go somewhere else. Look at this organization, they're an easier target based on the information that they're providing me online. And then again, they'll go through those steps of confirming that. So that's it. It's a pretty short one this time. I hope the information was useful. Again, we've got a bunch of information in the show notes that we'll post underneath this podcast. So we appreciate you taking the time to listen to us. As usual, please feel free to reach out. We are on Twitter at PreparedX. That's at PreparedX. Also, we have a LinkedIn group that just reached 1,000 members. So if you want to join that group and join in the conversation, that group is called Tabletop Exercises. That's Tabletop Exercises. So again, if you want to go to LinkedIn and join the 1,000 members of that pretty cool group, you can. And you can find out all things preparedness in that group. So again, until next time, I hope you've enjoyed this one, and have a safe day wherever you may be. Thank you.